Penguin Random House Audio presents Doom, The Politics of Catastrophe, written and read by Niall Ferguson.
Introduction. Still thou art blessed compared with me, the present only toucheth thee, but och, I backward cast my ee on prospects drear, and forward though I canna see, I guess and fear. Robert Burns, To a Mouse. Confessions of a Superspreader. Never in our lifetimes, it seems, has there been greater uncertainty about the future and greater ignorance of the past. At the beginning of 2020, very few people grasped the significance of the news coming out of Wuhan about a new coronavirus. When I first spoke and wrote publicly about the rising probability of a global pandemic in the week ending January the 26th, 2020, I was regarded as eccentric, certainly by the majority of the delegates at the World Economic Forum in Davos, who seemed oblivious to the danger. The conventional wisdom at that time, from Fox News to the Washington Post, was that the coronavirus posed a lesser threat to Americans than the usual winter wave of influenza. On February the 2nd, I wrote, "We are now dealing with an epidemic in the world's most populous country, which has a significant chance of becoming a global pandemic. The challenge is to resist that strange fatalism that leads most of us not to cancel our travel plans and not to wear uncomfortable masks, even when a dangerous virus is spreading exponentially." Looking back, I read those sentences as a veiled confession. I was travelling manically in January and February, as I'd done for most of the previous 20 years. In January, I flew from London to Dallas, from Dallas to San Francisco, and from there to Hong Kong, January the 8th, Taipei, January the 10th, Singapore, January the 13th, Zurich, January the 19th, back to San Francisco, January the 24th, and then to Fort Lauderdale, January the 27th. I wore a mask once or twice, but found it intolerable after an hour and took it off. In the course of February, I flew almost as frequently, though not so far, to New York, Sun Valley, Bozeman, Washington, D.C., and Lyford Key. You may wonder what kind of life that was. I used to joke that the lecture circuit had turned me into an international man of history. I realized only later that I might have been one of the superspreaders whose hyperactive travel schedules were spreading the virus from Asia to the rest of the world. My weekly newspaper column in the first half of 2020 became a kind of plague diary, though I never mentioned the fact that I was ill for most of February with a painful cough I couldn't shake off. To get through lectures, I relied heavily on Scotch. "Worry about grandparents," I wrote on February the 29th. "The mortality rate for people in their 80s is above 14%, whereas it's close to zero for those under 40. I omitted the less comforting data on asthmatic men in their mid-50s. I also left out the fact that I went to see a doctor twice, only to be told that, as more or less everywhere in the United States at that time, there were no tests available for COVID-19. All I knew was that it was serious, and not only for me and my family. Those who blithely say this is no worse than the flu are misstating the point. Uncertainty surrounds it because it's so difficult to detect in its early stages when many carriers are both infectious and asymptomatic. We don't know for sure how many people have it, so we don't exactly know its reproduction number and its mortality rate. There's no vaccine, and there's no cure." In another article published in the Wall Street Journal on March the 8th, I wrote, "If the US turns out to have proportionately as many cases as South Korea, it will soon have some 46,000 cases and more than 300 deaths, or 1,200 deaths if the US mortality rate is as high as Italy's. At that point, total confirmed cases in the United States stood at just 541, deaths at 22. We passed 46,000 cases on March the 24th and 1,200 deaths on March the 25th, just over 2 weeks later. On March the 15th, I noted, John F. Kennedy Airport was thronged yesterday with people doing what, since time immemorial, they've done in times of plague, fleeing the big city and spreading the virus. We're entering the panic phase of the pandemic. That was the same day I myself flew with my wife and my two youngest children from California to Montana. I've been here ever since. I wrote and thought about little else in the first half of 2020. Why this intense preoccupation? The answer is that although my core competency is financial history, I've been keenly interested in the role of disease in history ever since studying the Hamburg cholera epidemic of 1892 as a graduate student more than 30 years ago. Richard Evans's meticulously detailed study of that episode introduced me to the idea that the mortality caused by a deadly pathogen is partly a reflection of the social and political order it attacks. It was the class structure, as much as the bacterium Vibrio cholerae, that killed people in Hamburg, Evans argued, because the entrenched power of the city's property owners had been an insuperable obstacle to improving the city's antiquated water and sewage systems. The mortality rate for the poor was 13 times higher than for the rich. Researching the pity of war a few years later, I was struck by statistics that suggested the German army had collapsed in 1918 partly because of a surge of illness, possibly resulting from the Spanish influenza pandemic. The War of the World delved more deeply into the history of the 1918-19 pandemic, showing how the First World War ended with twin pandemics, not only influenza, but also the ideological contagion of Bolshevism. The work I did on empires in the 2000s also involved excursions into the history of contagious disease. No account of European settlement in the New World could have omitted the role that disease played in thinning the Indians to make room for the English, as John Archdale, the governor of Carolina in the 1690s, callously remarked. The title of the second chapter of my book Empire was White Plague. I was also very struck by the terrible toll of tropical disease on British soldiers stationed far from home. A man's chances of surviving a tour of duty in Sierra Leone were pitifully low, 1 in 2. Civilization devoted an entire chapter to the role of modern medicine in the expansion of Western settlement and rule, showing how colonial regimes meaningfully improved our knowledge of and ability to control contagious diseases, without glossing over the brutal methods often employed. The Great Degeneration explicitly warned of our growing vulnerability to the random mutation of viruses like influenza, while The Square and the Tower was essentially a history of the world based on the insight that network structures are as important as viruses in determining the speed and extent of a contagion. As I write, in late October 2020, the COVID-19 pandemic is far from over. There have been nearly 26 million confirmed cases, a fraction of the total number infected with the SARS-CoV-2 virus, to judge by seroprevalence figures from around the world. The death toll approaches 1.2 million, which is certainly an underestimate, as the statistics from a large number of countries, notably Iran and Russia, can't be trusted. And the cumulative body count continues to rise globally, at a rate of more than 3.5% a week, to say nothing of the number of people whose health has been permanently damaged, which no one has yet estimated. It seems increasingly likely that Lord Rees, Britain's Astronomer Royal, has won his bet with the Harvard psychologist Steven Pinker that bioterror or bioerror will lead to 1 million casualties in a single event within a 6-month period starting no later than December the 31st, 2020. Some epidemiologists have argued that without drastic social distancing and economic lockdowns, the ultimate death toll could have been between 30 and 40 million. Because of government restrictions and changes in public behaviour, it will surely not be as high. Yet precisely these non-pharmaceutical interventions have inflicted a shock on the world economy far greater than that caused by the 2008-9 financial crisis, potentially as great a shock as the Great Depression, but compressed into months, not years. Why write history now, when the story is not yet over? The answer is that this is not a history of our perplexing postmodern plague, though two of the later chapters, 9 and 10, offer a preliminary sketch of such a history.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?